And Christopher Dunn and Robert Schock, they'll stick around with your phone calls. All that's next on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, welcome back to Coast with Christopher Dunn staying with us, Robert Schock, and your phone calls. It is a fascinating field, both of you, Christopher and Robert. I envy you in part because I've never been in that region of the world. Robert, my father was born in Cairo.
Oh, really? Wow.
In 1923, and they stayed there 6 years before they came to the United States. And they were touring all over the place, and that's where he was, and boom, out he came.
And you've never been to Egypt?
I have never been to Egypt.
Oh, you have to go.
I would like to go. You know, I wouldn't mind going. You know, maybe if we set up a group with all of us and do some live coast-to-coast shows there.
Oh, that would be great.
That would be awesome.
We'll get...
I would love to be out in the field with Robert, too.
Yeah, that would be
last
wonderful.
Last year, I went with John Anthony West in February. And we had a... I mean, obviously, we don't all agree about the same thing. And we have different thoughts about the purpose for the pyramid, but we're a lot closer, I believe, than what a lot of people think.
I agree.
I know that Robert does not necessarily agree with the power plant theory, but I know in his book he did mention that he did think it was a large musical instrument, or it acted like a large musical instrument.
Exactly.
Which is exactly what I said in my book, that it was a huge musical instrument. So, and, you know, the spiritual aspects of it, I don't see that we're too far apart in a lot of things. And I know that the science within the pyramid is a question. And it's a huge question. But at least that is that can be tested and verified.
Okay, let's go to the phones, because that's what they're waiting for. Wildcard Line, you're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hi. I just wanted to ask if either of the guests had ever thought about the Sky Ground Plan extending off of the Giza Plateau, maybe into the village across the street from the Sphinx.
Is anybody familiar with that? You're crackling up on us, so I had to put you on.
Yeah, I couldn't hear what she was saying.
No, I know what she's talking about.
Okay, go ahead, Robert.
And I think it definitely extends beyond the Giza Plateau itself. What I believe the caller's referring to is the Giza Sky Plan, the concept that the three main pyramids are the Belt of Orion.
Oh, I see.
And mapping, basically, you're mapping stars in the sky on the Giza Plateau. And yes, I think that extends both north and south of the plateau, maybe going up into the Saqqara Plateau, the Dashur, et cetera, and also probably extends into the village. There, we know for certain that there are a lot of antiquities, a lot of sites that are now covered over by the suburbs of Cairo to the east of the Giza Plateau. And getting back to Zahi, actually one thing that he wants to do and is working on potentially instituting is moving out some of the villagers, giving them property elsewhere. And he wants to uncover some of the archaeological sites.
How close do people live to the pyramid structure?
Stone's throw, literally.
Really?
Yes, yes. It most people don't realize this, because if you have certain pictures of the Giza Plateau from certain angles, or say from the west, it looks like it's just all desert. In fact, it is on the edge of the Sahara Desert. But as Chris well knows, on the other side, east of the eastern side of the plateau, right in front of the Sphinx, there's the suburbs of Cairo, basically, are there.
Yeah, there's a village,
Nasrat
al-Zaman, right near the Sphinx, that is heavily populated.
What a view when you wake up in the morning, looking out your back window.
Oh, exactly. You can stay at the Mina House Hotel and look out the window and see the pyramids, and from the Mina House you can simply walk to the plateau very easily.
West of the Rockies, you're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hey, hi, this is Francesco in Hayford, California.
Francesco, welcome to the show.
Great to talk to you guys. I'm calling in regards of a ram pump theory I stumbled upon a couple of years ago, kind of been in the back of my mind. But
Edward Kunkel?
What's that?
Edward Kunkel?
Is that, I think, yeah, I actually built one of these ram pumps, and there was a link on this website, and it seemed fascinating how the inside, you know, basically added up to be one of these pumps. I guess whoever's not aware of what a ram pump is, it pumps water up to higher ground with water as the power. And I'm wondering what you guys think of that. I believe it was the pyramid of Cheops, however you say that?
Yeah, the Khufu pyramid or Cheops.
Okay, Cheops. Mm-hmm. So what do you guys think of that?
I'll let Chris go first.
Okay. I heard that theory back in the 70s when I first started to do my research. And I pretty much dismissed it. But because of the nature of the construction, and basically my feelings are that if you were going to pump water up that high, you wouldn't need a structure that covers 13 acres like that.
Uh-huh.
And so there's a lot of redundant masonry involved in this. Now, since then, I've been in communication with a gentleman by the name of John Cadman. And he contacted me and claimed that he had tried to test Kunkel's theory. And he's a maritime engineer, and he was very, very interested in Kunkel's theory.
Uh-huh.
And he found that he couldn't get it to work quite the way Kunkel described it would work. But he was seemingly impressed with my book, and he tried to impress me that the combination of hydraulics and what I presented in my book combined would work. Because in my book, I theorized that in the subterranean chamber was a mechanism for driving the pyramid to resonance. And he actually replicated the lower parts of the Great Pyramid, the descending passage and the subterranean chamber. His model, though, includes other shafts leading off from the chamber. However, he finally got my attention, and I flew out to Washington State, where he lives, in Bellingham, Washington, and he lives on the side of this hillside, and he had a catch pond with water filled, and he had the water coming down to a mechanism and a model of the subterranean chamber. And it was a very interesting story that he would get up at 3 o'clock in the morning. He was kind of like, Close Encounters of the third kind, fourth kind, when the guy was piling up mashed potatoes in his living room. Well, he was getting up at 3 o'clock in the morning, inspired, and he would be carving on this model of the subterranean chamber. Well, to cut a long story short, I flew out there to witness a demonstration, and accompanying. Actually wasn't accompanying me, met him there also, was a hydraulics engineer, Dr. Jack Cole, because he was there to witness it also. Well, something really, really interesting. He turned a simple valve, he turned the valve on to let the water flow. He allowed it to pump up to and release the air. And then he shut another valve off so that it would not be flowing vertically, but going down to a wastegate.
Uh-huh.
And the ground started to shake. And it actually had a beat. I timed the beat. It was 60 cycles per second.
Huh.
But the beat was quite interesting because it wasn't just a regular rhythm like a, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4. It beat like a heart.
Huh. From the water hammer.
Lubbed up. And I looked at Dr. Cole, and he looked at me, and I said, "Well, Dr. Cole, what's causing the heartbeat?" And he threw his arms up in the air, and he says, "I have no idea." But his replica was actually modeled after the subterranean chamber.
All right, thank you. Go ahead. East of the Rockies, you're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hello, George.
Yeah.
Hey. This is Joe from Columbus, Ohio. I was kind of curious if anybody's ever had the theory that since it was so long ago, like over 10,000 years ago or whatever, if anybody's having the theory that maybe gravity wasn't as great back at that time, that maybe over time the gravity's increased. I mean, that maybe that's how they, you know, put the blocks.
So it was easier to move the blocks?
Right.
What do you think? Who wants that?
Robert, you could take that one.
Well, I've certainly heard that theory many times. You know, that's the type of thing that would be very difficult to test on the one level. On another level, it really gets into a lot of complications because if gravity were that perceptibly lower, if it were that different than it is now, you would expect changes in organisms, you know.
True. They'd be bigger. Well, you know, there's talk, though, we had giants, Robert, on this planet.
And that ties in with that and how good is that evidence, that type of thing. I'm not saying it's something we can't consider, but it has a lot of ramifications that would have to be thought through.
Christopher, what about your thought? We talked about Edward Leed Scanlon and the possibilities of how they moved those stones. Do you think it was that some kind of technology beyond what people have said in the past, and that would be pulleys and ramps?
Yes, I think that it was something greater than pulleys and ramps. My hunch is that they were able to manipulate gravity in some way and lift those huge stones. When you look at the size of these blocks, they weigh 400, 1,000 ton statues, and the Ramses statues at Luxor, they're absolutely incredible. And they were able to move these huge objects and maintain, either they carved them with precision in place or they maintained the precision on the objects when they were moving them. So I think they definitely had something that we have yet to discover.
What about Margaret's theories that they can't find any quarries where some of these huge blocks would have come from?
Robert?
Oh, well, I think there are a couple of issues there. I'm not sure that, to be honest, I'm not sure that her argument along those lines is valid. There are a number of quarries. We have not mapped all the quarries. A lot of quarries are basically sanded in at this point, and we don't know their full extent. Also, it's a matter, the theory of poured blocks does not negate the concept of quarries. You still have to quarry that material somewhere, even if you're quarrying it as aggregate to make essentially concrete.
Then my old extraterrestrial theory would be that they were cut out somewhere and basically beamed over.
Well, beamed over is one thing, but actually I think we should go back to the water pump theory just for a second.
Because sure.
Something that Kunkel, okay, let me make two quick comments. I'm not convinced that the Great Pyramid was a water pump. I do think that you could potentially retrofit parts of it to turn it into a water pump. It just has that type of geometry. One of the big concerns I have from what I understand of the water pump theory is how you would get excess water out of the subterranean chamber once it's down there. I've been in the subterranean chamber a number of times, have explored all the passages that lead off of it, and at this point I'm not convinced there's any good way to get the excess water out of it. But getting back to Kunkel, who came up with the water pump theory, something he also promoted in his work was that the Egyptians were overcoming gravity, if you would, by using barges and docks, essentially canals, artificial canals, and then building docks, the basic procedure that's used to move huge ships up and down vertically. No, I'm not advocating that personally, but I do think it's an interesting proposal, if not for the pyramids, maybe for some of the other temples where they're using some kind of dock system. I'm sorry, did I say dock? Lock.
An interlocking system.
Locks where you have canals, like, and you have locks, and you can move to higher and more elevations.
Exactly. Let's go to our wild card line. You're on the air with us. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Good. Thank
my,
you.
My name is Michael. I'm in Albany.
Albany, New York. Sure.
Yes. What I have had an experience from time to time on doing healings that there are some negative things that come through on sound. And I'm wondering what sort of dark side technology you might be opening up and what will become as a result, you know? So I'm wondering, do you know that in some case you might be opening up a can of worms?
Well, who wants that?
No, I'm not sure what the question was.
Well, I think I understand the question. If you
go ahead.
As far as if we do research on new technologies, what kind of ramifications are associated with them, such as the development of nuclear power, there were negative and positive ramifications. I see that any kind of technology or any of our endeavors have both positive and negative to them. As far as the Great Pyramid, as I theorize it, I see a lot of positive aspects to it if it is used properly, and that is the harmonizing of the plates and the harmonizing of the people, and while at the same time generating energy. I know it's very, very radical and far-fetched idea, but that is basically what I have come to understand through my research.
I believe there was someone that had some music that they sold that were guests here at the George Noory Show. And that had some very dimensional effect of opening up a person to different dimensions. Are you aware of that?
Yes. I've heard of the stories associated with the Great Pyramid regarding how it affects people who spend some time within the King's Chamber or even inside the so-called sarcophagus. There are some significant effects associated with it. And until you actually experience it, it's easy to just dismiss it. But there are particular energies associated with the Great Pyramids, and it can have an effect. It can be very uplifting, it could strike the fear of God in you, as it has some researchers, visitors like Napoleon, who spent some time in the Great Pyramid, came out white as a sheet, and refused to go back in.
Okay, well, hold on. We'll be back with final phone calls, final comments in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. We'll be right back. We're going to take more of your phone calls. I want to remind you, though, we're still giving the double CD for the After Dark newsletter, the Malachi Martin classic interviews done by Art Bell years ago. Call 1-888-727-5505 or go online at coasttocoastam.com. Well, it'll be our final segment with final calls, but first, Christopher Dunn, what's on your plate in the future here with your research?
Thanks for asking. I'm actually heading back to Egypt on February the 15th. I'll be spending a couple of nights in London going to the British Museum, but I'm heading over with my co-author, Edward Malkowski, and we're going to spend a couple of weeks there. So, and then we're collaborating on a book which should be scheduled for publication 2008.
Excellent. And how about you, Robert?
Well, I continue to work in Egypt with the Great Pyramid and the other pyramids. And something that actually bears on the last question that we have had before the break is, now that I understand it, sort of what I would call the spiritual aspects of ancient Egypt. And I have become very interested in what exactly was going on with the pyramids, with the temples. And I believe much of it was sort of spiritual or sacred, or to use sort of different phraseology, psychical or paranormal. And so I've become very interested in those aspects. And this is something I think we find in all the sacred sites, or most of the sacred sites around the world, that they're there's a reason for them being built and exactly where they were built also. It's not just random. It's not just arbitrary. And I'd also like to make the point, and this ties in with my own research and the discussion we had just before the break. One reason, in my opinion, to study Egypt is that we have in Egypt a civilization that, yes, it had its ups and downs, but it had continuity and a stability going that lasted for thousands of years. And I think that's really something that we can learn from, what exactly was going on with the civilization that could have that continuity and relative stability for thousands of years. We look at our own civilizations, and they come and go in the blink of an eye compared to ancient Egypt.
All right, let's go to our wild card line. You're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hello. Are you aware that there's a Pythagorean triangle that's been polished into the basement stone in the so-called King's Chamber? It's also bisected in the golden section.
You too?
Yes, I believe that Peter Tompkins addressed that in his book, The Secrets of the Great Pyramid. I haven't actually done the measures myself.
Well, no, but do you know the phi proportion?
Mm-hmm.
Right.
And the, well, those two, where the Sphinx, the Leo, you know, the hindquarters of the Sphinx and the face of the Sphinx is bisected in the same golden section in the constellations of Leo and Virgo.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well then, are you aware of Philadelphius and Philae?
Well, what's the significance, though, sir, of all this stuff?
Well, the sacred proportions that are included in all of the, like at Karnak, the great pylon of Pi.
Right, right. They're incorporated into all these structures, and this is actually gets into, in my opinion, the work of Shuar de Lubitsch, who demonstrated this very specifically and with incredible measurements in his monographic studies, particularly of the Temple of Luxor, what he refers to as the Temple of Man.
Who do you think might have been the architect of these structures? Because whoever it was understood geometry and a lot of things.
I personally don't think it was a single individual. I think that you had actually a school. Some people nowadays might phrase it in terms of secret society or initiates, but I think it was knowledge and that was developed and passed on from generation to generation. You look at something like the temple at Luxor, and we know very clearly it's well documented that that temple was not all of one piece. It was built and rebuilt, and the axes, in fact, were shifted slightly over time, which has to do with stellar alignments. But it was built and rebuilt, but these harmonies and proportions and this continuity was maintained.
Okay, let's go west of the Rockies. You're up on Coast to Coast with us. Hello there.
George?
Yes.
George, name's Moy, Dearborn, Michigan. Just want to say you're my idol.
You didn't own a restaurant, did you?
No, I did not.
All right.
No, I did not. Moy from Michigan. I just want to let your guests know I was at the Coral Castle in Florida. One of the, I guess, the coordinators or the guides brought me and two other guys. He wanted to prove a point. He put me in the middle of a certain point in the Coral Castle, had the two other gentlemen, he had me stretch out my arms, had each guy on each side put their hands on my hand and told them to push my hands down with all their force, and I was to hold my force up. And the first time they did it, I just dropped. These guys were big guys. I'm only 5'7". These guys were about 6 foot. Then he said, okay, guys, step aside. He went to a certain end of the castle there, moved a certain rock, turned the rock in my direction, told the same guys to do the same thing with my arm straight up. These guys were big. They could not move my arms down. I had my arms straight up without, it was like nothing. They put all their force in. They could not move my hands down. It was quite amazing.
Well, there's no question that whatever was going on at Coral Castle, as we talked about earlier, Christopher, that guy knew. Ed Lead Skolnin knew what was going on.
Yeah, he had something that he wanted to protect, and unfortunately, he took it to his grave with him.
Sure did. Next up, east of the Rockies, you're on Coast to Coast. Hi there. Hello. Well, he is gone. Let's go to our first-time caller line. You're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi, good morning.
Yeah.
Or actually, good evening, I guess, where I'm at. Truck driver, long-time listeners, about 20 years or better. I have a question. How do they know they've discovered all the chambers? Is there a way to go through the stone and everything and, you know, like x-ray it or whatever?
Well, I would say the short answer is we don't know. In fact, there's a lot of speculation that there may be other chambers in the Great Pyramid. The empty space, the void, the chambers, the passages that we know about in the Great Pyramid are a very, very, very small percentage of the volume of the Great Pyramid. So, in my opinion, there is a possibility of finding more. Now, there have been some remote studies done trying to locate chambers, and they have not been universally agreed upon as being successful in finding anything. What I mean by that is that so far, the studies I've seen, nothing was found, but that doesn't necessarily preclude that there could be something, because there have been questions about the techniques used.
See,
they would have necessarily found everything.
And the port theory doesn't really address the chambers, does it? I don't think it does.
No, I don't think it does either, personally.
On what you said, Robert, on the exploration, the
remote. Go ahead, Christopher.
Yeah.
May I speak?
Yes, sir.
Oh, okay. The exploration of the southern shaft and the northern shaft, where they drilled through the plate and the southern shaft and they found a small space behind it. When they went up the northern shaft, they found the same, almost the same situation, where there were two fittings or metal fittings coming out from the limestone and down. And as you know, George, I was on your show before that exploration, and
right.
I had a prediction of what they would find. Unfortunately, the camera did not look behind, and the lighting was not that revealing, but it certainly did not negate the prediction that I had put out there, and also wrote about in my book. And so anyway, I just thought I would throw that in.
Right. I was going to say another possibility for finding directly other chambers and cavities is through, for instance, the grotto, which is, Chris knows what I'm talking about.
Mm-hmm.
If you go down the so-called well shaft from the base of the Grand Gallery into what's known as the grotto, which is essentially filled with rubble and has never, to my knowledge, been excavated.
Yeah. And I haven't been down there. Have you been down there, Robert?
No, I have not. I don't know anyone who's been down there.
It's
been closed off by the Egyptians for the last century, apparently.
Okay, first-time caller line, welcome to the program. You're on the air with us with Robert Schock and Christopher Dunn.
How you doing?
Good. Go ahead, sir.
Yeah, I was wondering if you had, between the four of you, any of your books on CD. And I was wondering about the religion part. Was it, do you think the pyramids were ever flooded by the 40 days and 40 nights rain?
I don't have any books on CD, and I don't really have a... I'm not a religious Bible scholar, so...
No, I'm not a religious Bible scholar either, and I don't have anything on CD, although various programs, a lecture that I gave, actually, in October, this past October, I think it was, is on CD.
Now,
that's available.
Robert, there's no doubt that the Sphinx has some incredible water erosion.
It does have incredible water erosion, and what I believe that's from, I'll be agnostic on the biblical flood at the moment. What the water erosion on the Sphinx is from, in my interpretation, my analysis, is actually from precipitation, so that's not incompatible with those that believe in the flood, and that came from rainwater. But you've got incredible amounts of precipitation causing the erosion and weathering on the Sphinx and the Sphinx enclosure, and I think that was taking place over a considerable period of time, but that period of time was before the modern Sahara was the Sahara Desert. So that's part of the story of how it places it well back in time, well back into pre-dynastic times.
Well, you know, I think about 20,000 years ago, I think that whole region was pretty lush.
Oh, yes, 20,000 years ago, absolutely it was.
We
also know that for the last 5,000 years, it's been absolute desert, much desert, and that's not compatible with the Sphinx having been built or carved initially 2500 BC, 4,500 years ago, because at 4,500 years ago, it was desert, and it's been desert ever since.
I remember a picture that I saw in high school when they were looking for parts of the Sphinx, and they uncovered it, and, you know, it was almost like just the head was above the sand, right?
Oh, yeah.
Originally?
Yeah, that's true. I mean, in the 19th century, early 19th century, it was only the head sticking out of the sand, and to this day, if the plateau were just deserted, wait a couple of centuries, I'm sure it would all fill in with sand again, and only the head would stick out.
You know, Robert, if they ever open up that chamber that you probably have found, Edgar Cayce always said that included in there was the Hall of Records of all mankind, teaching us the secrets of things.
Now, that would be something.
Oh, my gosh.
That would be incredible.
Let's go to our wild card line. You're on the air. Hi there.
Hi, George.
Hello.
I really find your talk on pyramids really fascinating, and I hope if you ever go there, since your roots is in Cairo, I would really love to go on a trip. I'd love to see the inside of them.
Maybe we'll do a coast-to-coast trip, huh? And
we need to do that.
Christopher and Robert together.
You guys are so
interesting. Pull that off.
So interesting. Like, just that last part about, you know, because, you know, the uncovered and the secrets, like Edgar Cayce. It's very, very fascinating. Well, I just wanted to tell a story that my uncle used to tell many times, and I never could really understand it, but, you know, from listening to your show and the people on it and also Coral Castle, when he was a young boy, him and his cousins, they said they were jumping on these big rocks. They're like big boulders. And one of his cousins jumped on this big one, and it threw him right off. I mean, it literally right threw him. And they left. They never went back. But I still think now, from what I've learned, there's got to be a place where these rocks are coming from. And I think you're right, like Ed, he did know how to use them and how to, you know, navigate them. Like, there just has to be a place where they're still around.
Christopher,
am I out of my world here when I say that?
No, not at all.
No.
Not at all. Christopher, who do you think taught Leeds Galton these secrets?
I think he probably worked on his own intuition, and
maybe he was reincarnated from the Egyptian days.
Yeah,
you never know.
Another Nikola Tesla.
Yeah, exactly. A couple more calls, and then we are done. East of the Rockies, you're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi, my name is Gary.
Hi, Gary. Where are you calling from?
Oh, I'm calling from beautiful downtown Des Moines, Iowa.
Wonderful. Go ahead.
Yes, I want to, you know, I'll just say what I got to say and listen over to you. Why don't you guys specialists in all this pyramid stuff and astrology and astronomy, why don't you check the Vatican out there? You know, observatory, why do they have it over there in Rome? And what's the big secret about Coral Castle? Why don't somebody take a big study on this guy? You know, where was he educated in? Is this all one big cover-up, like the government is covering up UFOs?
Well, Leeds Galton came from Eastern Europe.
From Latvia.
Yeah.
And his background was in masonry and logging.
What it is interesting that not a lot of people are doing a lot of research into him or how that was built. I guess, you know what? Pure science doesn't chase that, does it?
No, I mean, that actually gets back to something we talked about earlier, the problem of funding and, you know, it takes money. I hate to say it that way.
It does take money.
It takes money, and you know, when you have to do a full-time job otherwise and you do these things on the side. It's difficult.
Christopher, we're out of time. Robert, we're going to get you back for another show as well on the Sphinx. We've got to do that one. That's an incredible show. Both of you, thank you for being on Coast to Coast.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Very enjoyable.
And everybody's websites, all four guests that were on tonight are linked up at coasttocoastam.com. And if you haven't had the opportunity to go to those sites, do that because you're missing out on some great information. They all have their own theories. Their thoughts on how the Great Pyramid was built. I bet you have yours, and I have mine. I sometimes think that they were helped from above. Might be right. For Steve Carr, Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean LaDesur, Ross Mitchell, Ian Punnett, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.